It's 8:09. Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, if you are someone who has an interest in foreign policy, I guess this has been your decade so far, because that's where the action is. And a lot going on in the world. We have a war in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have troops there in harm's way. We have a country that is once again seeing their young men and women placed in harm's way, as I said, and this has caused a lot of turmoil among the population. And some people are asking the question, you know, how can we support the troops and not support the mission? And that's one of the questions we'll talk about this hour. There's also quite a bit of debate about what is going to happen in the Middle East in terms of U.S. policy vis-a-vis Iran. And that's another question that we're going to deal with in this hour. We'll talk probably a little more politics as well. So if you'd like to weigh in on those issues, here are your phone numbers, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number, 800-642-1234. In Madison, it's a local call for you. Please use 263-1890. If you would like to send us an email, here's the address, talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is Scott Ritter, former UN lead weapons inspector. He's the author of Target Iran, and his most recent work is Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. And Scott joins us by phone. Good morning, and thank you for spending this hour with us.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let me ask, put this question to you. How can we support the troops without supporting the mission?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that the troops are there to support us. Let's not reverse the order there. The United States of America does not exist to have an army, have an armed forces. The armed services exist to support the United States of America. And so we always have to keep that in focus, where our priority is. And our number one priority as citizens should be to preserve the United States of America. And then the question comes, what defines the United States of America? Is it our armed forces? Or could it perhaps be the Constitution that those who serve in the armed forces take an oath to uphold and protect? And once we understand that relationship, then we understand that we will support our armed services insofar as the armed services are carrying out their mission of upholding and defending the Constitution of the United States of America. But when that mission deviates, when that mission becomes something that is not consistent with that which defines us as a nation, as a collective, then that mission cannot be supported. The military of the United States of America is not the Roman Legion. We are not the Roman Empire, and it's not the Legion right or wrong. The military is an extension of who we are and what we are as a nation. And when the military is conducting itself in a manner which is inappropriate or inconsistent, then that mission must not be supported. We right off the bat, we have to start with that premise. But I also tell people that, you know, let's try and put it in an analogy, because we become so wrapped up in hyper-patriotism today that it's very difficult for people to comprehend what I just said. They say, well, wait a minute, no, we have to support our troops. And if our troops are engaged in harms, over there engaged in combat, we have to support their mission, or else we're somehow turning our back on the troops. I remind people that, when your house is on fire and you dial 911, you want the fire department to come, and you love your firefighters at that point in time. You support them. You want them to have the best equipment, the best training, the best leadership. Why? Because you need them. But do you support fires? And the answer is no. You support fire prevention. You recognize fires as, you know, this nefarious element, this evil element that destroys societies. We don't give medals to arsonists. We put them in jail. We support our firefighters, but we don't support fire per se. And therefore, the same analogy applies. We support our troops. We want them to be the best led, best equipped, best trained force in the world. But we don't support war. We need to support war prevention, recognizing that wars sometimes occur. And when they do, we want our military to be there to fight the war and fight the war to win. But that doesn't mean that we support all wars with open arms. We have to recognize that there are bad wars. There are wars we should not be involved in. And that is not disparaging on the troops. It's a recognition of the condition of war, that it's not something we should readily embrace. And people who say that we have to support the mission if we're going to support our troops are basically saying that we have a carte blanche to wage war around the world, and we don't.
800-642-1234 is the toll-free number to join our discussion this morning. 800-642-1234. In Madison, it's 263-1890. And the email address is talk@wpr.org. My guest this morning is Scott Ritter, former UN lead weapons inspector, and he's the author of Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement, and that is his most recent book. He's also the author of the book Target Iran. Scott Ritter, by the way, I should have mentioned this earlier. Scott, you'll be appearing in Madison this coming Saturday, I believe, from 9 a.m. to noon at the Wisconsin Historical Society on the UW-Madison campus. What are you going to be talking about at that gathering?
The Saturday gathering is something that's been coordinated with the Madison Institute, and the topic is Waging Peace, Citizenship in a Time of Unjust War, and it's pretty much going to address some of the topics we just hit on. How do we function as citizens, at a time when our nation's at war and we view the war as being a bad mission, a mission not worthy of the support of the American people? Is it, unpatriotic to vocalize against this war, or perhaps is it the most patriotic thing you can do? And we're going to wrestle with those issues.
Well, one of the things that I've been noticing is thanks to the internet, we get to find out what a lot of different people think around the country all at once, and that can be both good and bad. It's certainly not when you go out and look at the various blogs and forums and postings, it's not a scientific sample of what the population is thinking. But there are some interesting trends, and one of the things that I've seen as I've looked at some of this is the what's the word I'm looking for here? There's a lot of discomfort out there between concerning the rhetoric of the Bush administration, for example, about the war, and the rhetoric of certain of its spokespersons, secretaries of defense or whatever department, about the war in Iraq. And yet, then when the news reports come out that say, okay, well, we could have had, for example, these vehicles for the Marines that would be better protection against the roadside bombs 2 years ago, but we didn't because someone wouldn't spend the money, or we have soldiers having to go to junkyards to up-armor their vehicles and so forth. There's a real disappointment with the rhetoric about, we need to support the troops and support the mission and rah-rah, and yet what we find out is the people whose job it is to support the troops, who do support the mission, aren't doing it.
Well, and we can take it to even another level. How about when these soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines make the ultimate sacrifice? And, of course, I'm not talking about dying. I'm talking about a fate worse than death. I'm talking about, thanks to modern medicine, we can take people who would have died on the field of battle 20 years ago and sustain their life, but sustain their life in a manner which thrusts the responsibility of sustainment on their family. A 19-year-old, 20-year-old soldier, freshly married perhaps, gets his brain addled in an explosive ambush, comes home, spends the rest of his life in a wheelchair, his brain not functioning. His family has to take care of them. The nation forgets this soldier. The VA system forgets this soldier. The grateful nation that says supports the troops abandons this soldier. They abandon the amputees. They abandon those with mental disorders that are brought on by the horrors of war. We don't support the troops. It is a slogan used by people who seek citizenship on the cheap, people who wrap themselves in American flag and call themselves patriots. But we don't support our troops, because not only do we not give them that which they need to prevail on the field of battle, if the horrors of war catch up with them and their time comes and they get wounded, we abandon them when they come back home. So I'm somebody who is actually rather sickened by the little yellow bumper stickers you see across the country where people say support our troops. they support the troops with slogans only. There's no real support of the troops in America, unless you have a loved one deployed, unless you have a soldier, a sailor, an airman, a marine over there, somebody who is a part of your immediate family. The genuine support of the troops is superficial at best.
We're going to take some phone calls. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we've got full phone banks, and we'll get to those callers in just a moment, and we'll have more with Scott Ritter right after a little time out here. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:21. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. After 10 o'clock this morning, Chinese authorities are trying to improve air quality for the upcoming Olympics by ordering factory and construction shutdowns. After 10, Kathleen Dunn and her guests discuss how Olympic athletes are preparing their bodies to compete in the smoggy air of Beijing. That's coming up later this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about a lot of different things. Supporting the troops and not supporting the mission, maybe you do both. Maybe you do one or the other. We're talking about that. We're going to be talking about politics, intelligence, arms control, a lot of different things with our guest, former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter, here in this hour. And I said we would take some calls, and we're going to go to the phones right now, and we'll take a call first from Michelle in Madison. Michelle, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm going to preface this by saying that my brother was serving overseas in Afghanistan for a little over a year. We did support him. One of the things that I remember growing up is hearing about my dad coming home from Vietnam and being spit on and being kicked and basically berated for what he was doing. But nevertheless, in our family, we knew that that was a distinct possibility when my brother came home and when he was overseas from, you know, people in the community and what have you. But it was easy to support what he was doing, not necessarily a moral dilemma between what he was doing and the war, because I personally didn't support what was all going on overseas at that time. But it's easy enough to support the person through whatever means is necessary. If it's a matter of making sure that they have what they need to be able to do the job that they have, I don't think they were prepared enough to go overseas, either in Iraq or Afghanistan or where have you. But I also live in a very small community, and I saw the outreach when there were groups locally and, you know, that had ties locally, everybody coming together to send packages, and it wasn't 1 year. It was 3, 4, 5 years that every year still we get together and send hundreds of packages overseas to groups that, you know, maybe wouldn't have it. So I think overall there's a lot of different ways that you can look at it, whether or not you're supporting both the person or the initiative. But I think there can be a distinction, and I think there are a lot of people that kind of fall into that rah-rah bandwagon, like let's be patriotic and say we support them, but where's the action? Where's the true support?
Thanks for that call, Michelle. Scott?
Well, first of all, I mean, it absolutely. You know, she has a vested interest in this. Her brother was over there serving his country in harm's way. But as she points out, in a small, tight community, the community rallied. They took an interest, and you see that very much in the small communities where people, you know, they grow up with somebody, they grow up with a family, they come together in times of trouble, whether it be a natural disaster or in times of national crisis. And that's fantastic. I wish the entire country operated that way. I wish the entire country operated under the premise of adopt a soldier, because I'll tell you what. If that happened, you know, some people say that if there was a draft today, that we wouldn't have a war in Iraq, because if every college student at University of Wisconsin-Madison realized that, you know, come their second year, they're getting pulled out of college and they're going off to, you know, off to war, there'd be a heck of a lot more demonstrations. There'd be people saying, we don't agree with this war. There'd be families saying, not my son, not my daughter. But we don't have that. We have an all-volunteer military, and as a result, you know, we the the focus of concern is you know, lumped in with just a handful of people who have this direct vested interest. I wish the country adopted its military. I wish the nation viewed the military as an extension of its being, so that you didn't have to be the father, the brother, the sister, or a relative of a soldier to say, they're all my family, they're all part of me, I care very much about what happens to them. But that isn't what's going on in mainstream America today. The vast majority of Americans live their lives blissfully ignorant of the reality of what's going on in Iraq, Afghanistan, and what potentially could be going on in Iran.
Well, and we certainly aren't paying for it up front either. I mean, there's no there was a war surtax basically for the Vietnam War, for World War II, I think maybe even for Korea. I'm not sure about that one. I know World War II in Vietnam, there was basically a war tax that was placed to pay for the military conflict. We haven't seen this one, any sacrifice from anybody except the troops and their families for this conflict. And that's another thing that some people find disturbing.
Well, it's hard to say we're a nation at war when we don't behave like a nation at war. This war is one of the most expensive wars we've ever fought, but don't tell that to the American people. I mean, we're paying for it indirectly, but we disguise the costs. People don't understand the damage this war has done, or most people don't understand the damage this war has done to our economy. You know, basically, we have the printing presses on full. The process of government that oversees expenditures has fallen apart. Congress rubber stamps the largest ever defense expenditures, which are not inclusive of the war costs in Iraq and Afghanistan, because the executive office does not want to have a debate about the cost of this war. So they pass a defense budget, then they put on these emergency appropriations, and you're not allowed to vote against the emergency appropriation or criticize this process, because that's deemed as being against the troops. I mean, this is the danger of saying that we have to support the troops regardless, because due process goes out the window. I want my Congress to be debating what we're doing overseas. I want my elected representatives to ask the question, why is due process being flaunted? I don't want to turn the people's representatives into nothing more than a giant rubber stamp for a unitary executive gone wild. That's not the way America is supposed to function, and that's why I will not, buy into we have to support the mission if we're saying we support the troops. I say the best way to support the troops is to make sure we function as a nation worthy of the sacrifice we're asking them to make.
We'll go next to Jonathan in Fond du Lac. Jonathan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I'm pretty naive. I'm pretty young, so I don't really know everything. But is the war in the long run going to help American citizens? And if it does, then shouldn't we support it?
I think we can make a case for war if we can have that kind of linkage. And again, we say help American citizens. Not if how we define citizenship is a part of a nation that has embraced global empire. If we say that you'll help American citizens by aggressively acquiring resources that belong to other nations for the sole economic benefit of the American people, I would say maybe we don't want to go down that path. But if you can say that by waging war, we are improving the security of America, that there was a threat out there that was manifesting itself in a manner which brought harm to the American people or the American way of life, then I would say yes. That's why we go to war. We go to war to defend our interests, to defend our soil, to defend our people. And if you can make that case, that's why the war in Afghanistan is one that's is difficult to have blanket opposition to. A nation that harbored those who attacked us on September 11th, a nation that created the conditions for terror. I think a case can be made for our presence in Afghanistan. I cannot say the same about Iraq. We went to war in Iraq on false pretense. We lied about weapons of mass destruction. We lied about links with terrorism. And then our mission statement changes. I don't think we can make a case that our presence in Iraq is to the long-term benefit of the American people. And if you can't make that case, then we have to ask the question, why are we in Iraq? And do we continue to support a war that bankrupts us fiscally and morally as a nation?
Thanks for that call, Jonathan. I want to move our discussion along to some other topics, and we've got some people who want to help us do that. And I'll start with an email from Carol. Carol says, could you talk about the topic of war with Iran? I was disturbed last night by the discussion of massive retaliation against Iran if they were to send a missile to Israel. I think that this is unspeakable. It would cause a world war.
I think we, first of all, need to recognize that there is a very dangerous situation that exists between the United States and Iran right now. I don't think people are seeing past the headlines, and the headlines say two things. One, that Iran is the greatest threat to the security of the United States of America today, and two, there are no immediate military plans. I mean, let's go back to your previous caller. With all due respect to those who create the headlines, if Iran is the greatest threat to the national security of the United States of America today, there better be immediate war plans. I mean, if this threat is so large as the president says it is, that's a war I will support. The problem is that Iran is no such threat. The president, once again, exaggerates this threat and is using it as a false pretense to get the United States involved in a conflict. And I don't believe the president's being honest when he says there are no plans to attack Iran. There are plenty of plans. As the email says, one plan is if Iran sends a missile against Israel, we have a plan for a massive retaliation. I would imagine that we also have plans for preemptive action against Iran to ensure that no missiles are sent. But we have to ask ourselves, why would Iran send a missile? Are they just going to one day wake up and push a button and off goes the missiles? Or it will be in reaction to aggressive American policy in the region. People need to ask ourselves, what is the policy of the United States? Is the policy of the United States with Iran truly solely focused on eliminating the potential threat posed by Iran's nuclear program? Or could it perhaps be regime change, that the United States wants the theocracy in Tehran removed and is looking for any vehicle to facilitate accomplishment of this mission? These are some of the questions we as a people need to wrestle with. We need to have our elected representatives discussing. We need to have those who seek office discussing. And yet you don't see Iran dominating the debates that are taking place today amongst those who claim they want to be president of the United States of America. I will tell you this. Whoever's president next time around, Iran's going to be one of the big issues they're going to have to wrestle with. And there's a good chance that the next president will be sworn in at a time when the United States is already engaged in military operations against Iran. We need to start focusing on these issues more.
What do you mean by that? Do you think that President Bush is going to take some action against Iran before he's out of office?
The president has said that he seeks to resolve the Iranian problem prior to leaving office. He defines Iran, the problem of Iran, in stark terms. I always say that if you define a problem only as a nail, the only solution becomes a hammer. He claims that all options are on the table, but the problem that he defines with Iran, a nation pursuing an illegal nuclear weapons program, a nation that is the largest state sponsor of terror in the world today, and more recently we had General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker testify before Congress about the fact that all of America's ails in Iraq are due to Iran's interference, and the president called the Iranians criminals who will be crushed. You tell me what the president's planning.
I'd be the last person to be able to do that. Let's go to...
But I would say that we have to engage our thinking caps. And if we have somebody saying, using this rhetoric, I think we have every bit of reason to be concerned about the direction they're taking us, and that we can't simply allow statements that say there are no military plans on the table at this time to mollify us. Remember, the president warned us repeatedly in 2002 that there were no military plans against Iraq, and we now know, thanks to the U.S. Army's chronology, that he signed off on the execute order on August 28th, weeks and months before he made the statements that there are no military plans. We have a lot to be concerned about, and therefore a lot of reason to be engaged.
Mike in Langlade County is next. Mike, good morning.
Good morning. I agree quite a bit with your caller, but I'd like to point something out. We had no business whatsoever engaging war in Iraq. We were pushed into that by the neocons, who thought it their idea was induce democracy into the Middle East, and that'll support peace. Well, that's a flawed notion. Bush said, and he got it from, it's well known that he got this notion from a book by Nathan Sharansky, a Russian emigre, that all men love freedom, democracy is the road to freedom, therefore push democracy into the Middle Age, into the Middle East, and we'll have peace. That position is flawed. People who don't know anything about democracy, people who have never lived under democracy or freedom, which includes the whole Arab world plus most of Russia, are absolutely clueless in general about what freedom is and whether they might like it or not like it. That's why Russia has fallen back into authoritarian rule and loves Mr. Putin. He's got an 80% approval rating. Bush is under 30 and sometimes under 20. Now, and war is always pushed by old fogies in Washington that send our youngsters out to be killed. And in this particular case, most of them were a bunch of draft dodgers like Dick Cheney and George Bush. And the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in Vietnam was the same BS. It was hoaxed up by the government to allow us to expand our influence there. We do have a legitimate gripe against Iran. We should be over there telling them and the world they will not be allowed to have a nuclear weapon threat. And whatever we need to do, with or without the support of the rest of the world, we will prevent them from having a nuclear threat. And we ought to be telling the same thing to the North Koreans in their sphere of the world where they're sitting so close to China and to Taiwan and to Southeast Asia. But Bush, the warmonger, hasn't done squat, refuses to go to Iran and tell them the truth, as he ought to, and refuses to go to Korea and tell them the truth, as he ought to. And instead, he's engaged in this war in Iraq, where we are now, the price of gasoline, it's reported this morning, has doubled in the last 3 years. I would remind you and the callers, the price of a barrel of oil at the end of the Clinton administration was under $20 a barrel. Because of this dimwit's foreign policy, the United States is sending billions of dollars to the mullahs who are turning around and killing our soldiers with it.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Scott, a lot to chew on there.
I think we need to look at a couple of things. First of all, you know, how the United States interfaces with the rest of the world. I'm a big proponent of, you know, securing the realm, so to speak. I don't believe that we should be isolationists, and I don't believe that we should sit by passively while threats present themselves. But I do recognize that in a world of nearly 7 billion people, we only comprise 300 million of that population. And the concept that 300 million people get to dictate to 6.8 billion others the terms of coexistence is fundamentally flawed. And so I don't agree with the concept of America extending its power willy-nilly as only America sees fit. We're part of a global community, and we need to find a way to interact with the global community respective of a framework of laws that all parties agree upon and all parties are held accountable to. And one of the problems we have today is America doesn't behave in that fashion. The other concept is, I agree, you don't impose democracy. Democracy only grows from within, and that's one of the fundamental flaws of the Bush administration's premise, that if we bring democracy, we plant the seeds of democracy, peace and prosperity will follow. But if the method of planting the seed is through violence and destruction, it's a corrupt seed, and all it'll bring about is death and despair. Nations have to decide for themselves the direction they want to take. The United States can seek to serve as a model, and we can seek to provide assistance, non-military assistance, to help promote democracy. But at the end of the day, you can't impose democracy. It has to come from within, and that's one of the fundamental flaws of the Bush administration's approach to the world these days.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of that the joke work poster that says the beatings will continue until morale improves.
That's right. And if the results of Iraq weren't so tragic, I mean, you know, it'd be fine. But it's basically the soldiers will keep dying until morale improves.
Yeah, and that's the tragedy here. Let's go to Mark in Superior next.
Hi, thank you for letting me talk to Scott Ritter. First, as a citizen and as a former Marine Corps NCO, I applaud your dedication, Scott.
Well, thank you very much. Super fine.
I have a question and a comment that kind of ties in with it. Much has been made that a lot of our leadership in Washington who make these decisions haven't served in the military. Now, it's a lot easier to call names than to delve deeper into the thing. One, I wanted to know how important you think it is that at least some of the decision makers have had military experience, and two, as a former Marine, but also as a peacetime Marine, I mean, there's a tendency, and I hate to admit it because it's very immature, but I mean, there's a get some mentality that isn't just from the non-military leadership, but maybe also from some of the peacetime people. And having experience in that world, how important do you think it is that at least some of these people have had some kind of military leadership or military experience, excuse me?
First of all, I spent 12 years in the Marine Corps, and I was 12 of the best years of my life. I love the Marine Corps as an institution, and I'm very proud of having been a Marine and of those who are Marines today, and soldiers, sailors, airmen too, but, you know, sort of prejudiced in favor of the Marine Corps. Having said that, you know, I don't believe that we can allow citizenship to be defined by a litmus test that says you have to have served in the military. I believe there are other ways to be a good citizen, and there are many ways to serve your country, and not all of those require you to wear the uniform. And so as frustrating as it is sometimes to take a look at the resumes of the politicians who are in Washington, D.C., and say, you know, there's a paucity of military experience here, I would say, you know, that's just the price of being an American, that we don't have this litmus test, that it isn't a prerequisite. I do believe that, you know, if you were going to run a business or an organization and you didn't have experience in doing a specific task, that you would surround yourself with people who did have this experience. And therefore, if you're a president who doesn't have military experience, that you would seek to ensure that some of your close advisors did in fact have this experience. It's just a sound way of doing business. And, you know, one of the problems, to bring up your other point about the peacetime Marine Corps, look, I spent a lot of time in the Marine Corps and the peacetime Marines in the 80s, and you bet we had to get some attitude. We were gung-ho about it. We trained to go to war. We wanted to have the opportunity to strut our stuff. And the quickest way to throw a wet blanket over that was to actually go to the Gulf War and see it up front, see what war was. And the Gulf War was nothing compared to what the Marines are experiencing today in Iraq and Afghanistan. But it certainly tempered the enthusiasm for war. Suddenly war became something that you shouldn't just rush off and say, yee-haw, I'm on this grand adventure. You realize that there was tremendous sacrifice that was entailed by war, and that it should not be irresponsibly pursued. And, you know, that's why I think you need to have military veterans around who will raise their hand in the back of the room to ask the uncomfortable question, while civilian leaders who haven't been in the military are saying, hey, let's draw the big arrow on the map, let's go here, let's do this, let's do that, and have somebody raise their hand and say, excuse me, let's talk about the reality, the consequences of what you're talking about. It's important that we make sure that we don't view war as a game, and membership in the military is being something akin to the Boy Scouts. It's not. It's a deadly serious business, and it should not be undertaken lightly, and we need to ensure that those who are responsible, and the Constitution gives control of the military to the civilian leadership, and we shouldn't forget that. We need to make sure that civilian leadership is well advised on how to use the military they've been entrusted with.
I had an email from someone who suggested that one way to prevent further wars would be to insist that the first wave of troops needed to include the children of all of the civilian leadership.
That's a little selfish. I prefer the first wave of troops to be to consist of the most highly trained warriors we have, so that when we engage the enemy, we destroy them immediately and the war is shortened. But that's just my personal preference.
Well, I think that was a metaphor,
but,
but yeah. We have an email from Al in Milwaukee, and he says, to me, it is an outrage that somebody is talking about a nuclear war for the sake of Israel. How did we get to this point? And let's have it out in the open. No more of this. Israel is untouchable, and we can't talk about it that we hear in the American media, including public radio. That's from Al in Milwaukee.
Well, I mean, Israel is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. We keep talking about Iraq. We talk about the Middle East. We talk about Iran. We speak of Iran's nuclear program. We speak of the horrors of Saddam's regime. But, you know, we don't speak of the fact that in 1996, a group of pro-Israeli ideologues wrote a paper that basically said that it's in the best interest of Israeli security if the United States removes Saddam Hussein from power, that Israel should be seeking to get the United States to do that. We don't get into discussion that basically the Iranian nuclear program is defined by Israel. The red lines are established by Israel. The United States assumes this. That means that we allow that which defines what a nuclear weapons program is to be shaped simply by Israel's refusal to allow Iran to have any uranium enrichment capability at all, even though the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is Iran is a signatory to, Israel is not, Article 4 says that a nation that has signed up to this and subjects itself to safeguard monitoring inspections is permitted to have uranium enrichment programs. Iran's doing nothing illegal, but we've allowed Israel to define the Iranian program on terms that are inconsistent with international law, and yet have the United States inching closer to military conflict with Iran. And, you know, ultimately we have a situation where there were people in Congress, who said that we should perhaps write rules and regulations, pass a resolution that says the president can't use U.S. taxpayer dollars to go to war with Iran without the permission of Congress, i.e., that which the Constitution mandates. And there were those in the Congress, Democrats, Nancy Pelosi among them, who said they will not allow any such legislation to be passed because it will tie the president's hands when it comes to protecting the national security of Israel. And I, as an American, have a problem with having the Constitution shunted aside in the national security interests of a non-American entity. And I say this as somebody who spent 4 years in Israel and considers myself to be a friend of Israel. I'm not out here Israel bashing, but I'm an American first and foremost, and I think it's time that we get a little bit selfish on these issues, that we don't go to war for other nations. We go to war for our own vested interests. And if Israel is carrying out policies which are inconsistent, you know, there's that old saying, friends don't let friends drive drunk. And maybe the best thing America, the friend of Israel, can do is tell the Israelis no when what they want is bad not only for America but for Israel and the rest of the world. And I do believe that the current Israeli posturing vis-a-vis Iran is bad for Israel, America, and the rest of the world.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we have some more people who want to join us by phone, and you could be one of them if you call 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's about 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine this week. Next hour, Kathleen Dunn welcomes Amy Mitchell, Deputy Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, to be a guest on her program as they discuss the status of the news media in 2008. That's coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network, so stay tuned for that. This hour, we have with us Scott Ritter, former UN lead weapons inspector. He's the author of Target Iran, and his most recent work is Waging Peace, the Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. Scott, before we move on, there was a question I meant to ask you earlier, and it's something I've always been curious about. How does one become a UN weapons inspector?
Well, there's a couple tracks. The first one is to actually have expertise in the field, you know, that's being pursued. There is no standing UN weapons organization anymore. When they dissolved UNMOVIC, the organization that was in Iraq in 2003, basically this expertise that had been assembled by the international community for more than a decade was dispersed. And so what happens, you have to get a mandate. That's the first thing, is the international community has to say there is a mandate to do the job. For instance, the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, Austria, has a mandate to do nuclear inspections. From that mandate, you know, specific jobs emerge, requirements, and you let it be known that you need people to hire to apply, and they apply. They said, if you want to be a nuclear inspector, you better have some experience in the nuclear field, extensive experience. They don't let dilettantes in. You've got to be, you know, preeminent in your field. The same thing with biology. You bring in this the not just good biologists, but people who have dabbled in biological weapons. Same chemicals. You need chemical weapons people, ballistic missile experts to do the missile inspections. Or in my case, when the inspection task becomes difficult and the inspected party seeks to retain information and deny it to the inspectors, you bring in somebody who's an expert at gaining access to information in denied environments. We sometimes call those people spies. But as long as you're doing it in accordance with a mandate, then you're just simply inspecting by other means. But the bottom line is the mandate you know, shapes the requirements, and then you go out and you attract the talent. I was asked to be an inspector. I was asked by an Army colonel who I worked with in Russia, who said that there was a need, and he sent a by name request for me. When I became a chief inspector, I would design a mission to go into Iraq, take a look at the specific skill sets that were needed, and then send letters out to heads of government saying, I need your best computer scientist. We need your best linguist. We need your best biologist and chemist. And then nations would send these inspectors. It's not something that you know, today say, I want to be a UN weapons inspector, because there aren't any jobs out there for you. You have to say, I want to be, you know, a nuclear physicist, and you want to study nuclear weapons. And then if the time and place comes where the international community has a requirement, maybe your skill set's what's needed, and you can get the job.
Let's take a call next from Saeed in Green Bay. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. Your guest speaks of regime change in Iran with such antipathy that it clearly demonstrates that he doesn't know that is the democratic aspirations of the Iranian people is exactly that regime change in Iran is the dream of the masses of Iranians who live under this tyrannic regime, whose policies have not only failed to deliver in terms of jobs, economy, but has brought Iran to war. Some 700,000 Iranians died in that war, and now is bringing Iran again to the brink of war. So the pro-democratic policies of the Bush administration are nothing to be criticized in this fashion.
Well, that's curious to say. I know nothing about it. I actually traveled to Iran. I've spent a lot of time talking to Iranians, and I would say that there is a desire inside Iran for a change. The Islamic Revolution is over. The Shah is gone, and there are people who are saying that it's time for Iran to catch up with the modern ages. I spoke with Revolutionary Guard commanders who said that perhaps the focus of the theocracy shouldn't be religion, but the people, and improving the conditions. So there is this this desire for change inside Iran. But when you bring up the issue of if that change comes at the at the point of an American bayonet, I would violently disagree with the caller. The Iranian people will not put up with that. And remember, George W. Bush speaks of regime change not through peaceful change from within, but imposing. We have to judge people on past patterns of behavior, and we take a look at how we achieved regime change in Iraq. And I would certainly hope that the caller isn't suggesting that the best thing for the people of Iran would be a repeat of what's occurring in Iraq. And I would also state this, that regime change in Iran is an Iranian problem. not an American problem. And I would certainly hope that the caller is not suggesting that American blood need to be shed to improve the plight of the Iranian people, that perhaps this is a plight best served by the Iranian people doing that which they deem necessary to achieve the change inside their country. But this is not an American problem. It's not worthy of the sacrifice of American lives, and I'm in violent opposition to any American policy that would put American troops sworn to uphold and protect the Constitution of the United States in harm's way simply because the Iranian people are incapable of resolving their own problems themselves.
May I answer that?
Sure, go ahead. Be quick, though.
For the American liberals and for this speaker, the only way when we talk about democratic change in Iran, they think that the only way is through the use of American force and American military. There are other options. Did the world not have a responsibility in supporting the freedom movements in Poland, for example? When Ronald Reagan and Polk created an international milieu in which the efforts of indigenous movements within Poland could result in democratic change. The same thing can be done here. Let me give you examples. The Iranian labor movement, the Tehran city bus drivers have been in an uprising. The labor movements across the world have expressed sympathy and solidarity with the Iranian labor movement. American labor movement is absolutely quiet on this. The Iranian feminists are fighting a very tough battle for the most basic of human rights, and they have support from the feminist movements around the world, but not from American feminists.
Okay.
There are other things besides military. I agree that no Iranian wants American military involvement in Iran, but that does not excuse the greatest democracy in the world from owning up to its responsibility of putting the weight of its moral force behind the indigenous movement of Iranian people that are fighting for rights.
Thank you for that. We got to go. We're just about out of time. I wish I'd gotten this call a little earlier. Scott, as we finish here, I want you to remind people where you're going to be this Saturday in Madison.
Well, on Saturday, there's a forum at the Wisconsin State Historical Society Auditorium. I think it's 816 State Street on the University of Wisconsin campus, hosted by the Madison Institute. It's Waging Peace, Citizenship in a Time of Unjust War. And we can talk about, you know, Iraq, and what a fantastic dialogue we were having there on Iran, where, you know,
yeah,
we sit there and we wrestle with the issue of, you know, what is appropriate for the United States, policy direction.
The clock is our tyrant here.
I know.
Scott, thank you so much for this hour.
Thank you, sir.
Scott Ritter, a former U.N. weapons inspector and a former United States Marine. We thank him for his service and for his time with us today. Karen Prager produced the program. Christina Taylor handled on-air production. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network at Wisconsin Public Radio.